Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Bananas today. Big blue skulls, big blue skulls, big blue skulls. Let's make little blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome back to The Henson Perspective. Once again, we're talking about an episode of The Muppet Show 45 years after its New York City broadcast, now in 1978.
Hey-o!
This originally aired on January 23rd, 45 years ago, after having been produced as the first episode back from their mid-season production break between October 18th and 21st of 1977. This episode guest stars famous opera singer, ballet dancer, Rudolf Nureyev, and was reputedly a major step forward in the reputation of The Muppet Show. We talked last season about how getting Lena Horne was the thing that enabled them to finally have guests that took the show seriously and were willing to appear on it. And according to internal Muppet legend, the appearance of Rudolf Nureyev was the thing that got the third season basically to be a cakewalk.
Yeah.
And that there was an exponential increase in people wanting to appear on the show. We talked about how the viewing figures were huge, how so many people watched the show, but apparently some people still needed convincing, and the appearance of Rudolf Nureyev on the show helped do that. I think that's not just because Rudolf Nureyev was such a get. I think this might be the best episode of the season.
Wow.
Now, it does trail off a little bit in the final third to quarter of the show, but I think the writing on this episode is the best we've seen in the season so far.
Interesting. I think that this aired the day after a very important date.
What happened in 1978 on January 22nd?
It's what happened 6 years after that.
Okay. No idea what that would be.
Because you're a bad brother.
Six years after that, a month before, was a very important date.
Ben, on the podcast, you haven't done the December part of the bit yet.
I don't know what you're talking about. This is a strict no-bits podcast.
Jimmy Smith's
a guest member.
A guest on The Muppet Show.
Or Muppets Tonight.
Oh, that would have been great.
They did have a NYPD Blue satire on one
yes.
of the Muppets Tonight episodes.
They absolutely did.
So there's probably a Muppet version of Jimmy Smith's.
Yeah.
This is a pro-Muppet Smith's podcast.
But yeah. I don't understand. Having done the research for this episode on Rudolf Nureyev, and we'll get to this very shortly in the quiz, I know why he was famous for his dancing. I don't know why him being on the show would have been the moment that made people go, oh, because he didn't do a lot that wasn't dance.
In the show, you mean?
Externally to the show, okay. As well. It's not like some of the other people we've seen as guest stars who are like crossover or like trying to get into acting.
Maybe he was just doing this to bring art to the masses. Not unlike the Mom and John's episode.
Yeah, it's a good one. Except, I mean, I can't speak for this because I wasn't around then. Rudolf Nureyev is undoubtedly more famous than Mom and John's.
Yes, and I would say most people would consider ballet to be a higher form of art than mime.
Yes. Well, while we're talking around Rudolf Nureyev, why don't we test what you do know before I may or may not give away information accidentally. Question number one. Rudolf Nureyev was the first artist to defect from the Soviet Union during the Cold War. This was a big blow to the Soviet Union, as ballet was a key propaganda tool for the Soviets. They claimed it showed their cultural superiority to the West. The final straw for Nureyev was on a 1961 trip to which country that he had to fight to perform in the first place, despite being their star male performer. While on the trip, he was followed and repeatedly told by the KGB minders that his behavior was unacceptable. I said country. All my answers are cities.
Okay. Do you want to retake that, or do you just want to leave this in?
No. So, Ben, which city was he in when he decided to defect? A. Berlin. B, London, or C, Paris?
Paris.
Correct. He decided to defect at the Paris airport when the KGB told him that he had to return home to perform, but Nureyev was convinced that he was being punished for his unbecoming behavior while in Paris. And so he was afraid, and one of his friends that he made while in Paris, who I had forgotten their name and didn't write down, convinced him to slip his minders and get to a Paris police officer and ask for asylum, which he did. And
the rest is history.
Yes. Question two. Speaking of Rudolph's defection, it served as a focal point for the 2018 biopic about him called The White Crow. This movie was directed by whom?
Ralph Fiennes.
Damn.
He learned Russian to be able to direct the actors in it because he needed a ballet dancer who could act rather than an actor who pretended to be able to do ballet. And so he directed that whole movie in a second language. It's an incredible... I haven't seen it, but just the production aspects of it are an incredible feat.
A, Kenny Ortega. B, Ralph Fiennes. Or C, Stephen Daldry.
I'm going to go with B.
Correct. The movie was called The White Crow because it was a childhood nickname for Nureyev because he was so odd that he was like a white crow. Question three. In 1977, Rudolph had his first non-ballet role in a movie directed by Ken Russell. Uncle Ken also directed The Who's Tommy, and his next film after this was the cult classic Altered States. Rudolph was cast as the titular role in Valentino, where Rudolph played Rudolph Valentino. Rudolph Nureyev, who was very famously very passionate about his work and would often butt heads with collaborators, had issues with both Uncle Ken and which female co-star? A. Anne Margaret, B. Carol Kane, or C. Michelle Phillips?
A.
Incorrect. It was Michelle Phillips, the former singer for The Mamas and the Papas.
Oh, okay.
It was her second role in movies, and they clashed because it was reported that Michelle had a loose way with acting, and Rudolph had difficulty acting against her free-flowing nature, which isn't shocking considering he's a dancer. His whole thing is practice, routine, perfection. So for her to one take do it this way and then another take do it a completely different way, he had difficulty acclimating. There we go. To it. Question number four. As his body was beaten down from all the years of dancing, shortly after this episode, while still dancing occasionally, Rudolph Nureyev became the artistic director for which ballet? A. The Australian Ballet. B. The National Ballet of Canada. Or C. Paris Opera Ballet.
C.
That is correct. He actually did so much to reform the Paris Opera Ballet, possibly the most prestigious ballet company in history, that they have decided that since his death, that every 10 years in March, which is his birth month, they will have an honorary performance in his honor. Oops. Question 5. Speaking of his death, and since this is the last question, let's talk about Rudolph's death. He was diagnosed with AIDS in 1984, but on which date did Rudolph Nureyev pass away? A. January 6th, 1993, B. January 22nd, 1984, or C. January
28th,
1986. C. Incorrect. That was the date of the Challenger explosion.
Never forget.
The answer is A. January 6th, 1993, which makes today, the day of this recording, the 30th anniversary of Rudolph Nureyev's death. Going back to question four for a moment, that means that this March there should be
the
honorary performance in his honor. So if anyone who's listening is in Paris this March, take a look out. A very quick Google search that I did this afternoon, I could not find any reference to any upcoming performances about it. Maybe it's too early, being early January. Also, going back to talking about the loosey-goosey style versus the perfection, Rudolph Nureyev once said, "Technique is what you fall back on when you run out of inspiration." Which is weird that that then clashed with her loosey-goosey style, because that sort of leads you to believe like, oh yeah, no, you go back and do it the way you've been trained when you don't have any other ideas. But it's still the same move, I guess. He was also described as, in an article I found on Time.com, one moment he could appear to be in perfect control and the next on the edge of spinning out of control. His fans said that his unpredictability only added to his magnetism. Again, like, you never knew what you were going to get with him, but it was always going to be perfection. So yeah, he didn't do much other than dancing. Like that Valentino role was his first non-dancing film performance. Every other credit on IMDb that I could find was a film performance of a dance.
Well, I noticed your surprise at my high evaluation of this episode. I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if you were to stick Rudy somewhere in the middle of the pack, because while I think his performances in the episode of what he does to both subvert and accentuate what he's notorious, I think he does a good job of both doing what he's famous for and breaking through what he's famous for. But his performance is stilted.
Yeah.
It is awkward. He sometimes is able to do fun and funny with some fluidity, but mostly not. And so I'm not remotely surprised that he wasn't able to have a breakout crossover career, because it seems clear to me, based on this episode, that he wasn't that kind of a performer.
Yeah.
I found him to be winning, but as I said, mostly, I think this is an exceptionally well-written performance, and I think it highlights the Muppets and him very well in terms of stuff for him to do. His line readings in what may be his third language.
Yep.
At which order he achieved languages, I have no information. I'm assuming he has Russian and French before English.
And I think Russian isn't even his first language, because he was born Tartar Muslim in Russia, but his parents spoke Russian to him, but it wasn't really Russian, because once he went to school and was learning Russian, he was like, oh, this isn't what I've been speaking at home.
So he spoke some sort of pidgin Russian in the home.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So, yeah, probably Russian was his second language, French his third, and English his fourth. So he does a good job of trying to sell punchlines and be on target, but it is not easy to understand him all the time, and his inflection is unsurprisingly off in that he doesn't necessarily punch the right words in order to make things clear or to really hit the laugh lines.
Mm-hmm.
But he's such a good performer in the physical stuff, and he's doing what the show asks of him. So, apparently, game.
Yeah. Let's talk about the episode so we can talk about him in specifics rather than generals.
Well, interestingly enough, however, the general introduction that we normally get of a guest doesn't have Rudolf Nureyev in it, because in the opening, when Scooter knocks on the door of the dressing room, he comes in wearing a tuxedo, looking very spiffy, and announces that there's 15 seconds to curtain, but Rudolf Nureyev is not in the dressing room. And from this first appearance, I was literally wondering, is this going to be a meta episode? Is this going to be a thing where Nureyev is actually in less of the episode than I thought? And one or two things helped me continue to wonder whether or not this might actually be the least amount of screen time a guest had in the show.
Yeah, it definitely seems like this episode is backloaded with Nureyev. Mm. But yeah, I really like the joke where Scooter looks at the camera and says,
uh-huh. I knew he was too smart to show up.
And taking that in terms of context of apparently how successful this show was in getting future guest stars, the fact that it starts with a line of saying a guest star would be smart not to appear on this dumb show,
yeah,
is really icing on the cake.
Scooter did give Rudolf a 15-second curtain call, and the curtain goes up at 14 seconds, so pretty good. Statlin Waldorf sing along sarcastically to the song, which I really enjoyed.
I was wondering, because you'd said in the past you like it when their joke is in rhythm with the music, and so for them to just do a vocal of the song, I was wondering which of the Goldilocks' three bears that would be, whether it would be too on the nose, whether it would be too sarcastic, or whether it would be just right.
Just right.
And then Gonzo inflates a green balloon out of the bell of the trumpet, which then continues to inflate after he stops playing, which makes him confused and a little scared.
Mm-hmm. Didn't love that, but I like the look that he gave as he was confused, but I was also confused as to what was happening, so I didn't like it.
I didn't notice the confused look the first time I watched the episode. And so watching back to realize that he was as weirded out by it as I was made me like it a little bit more.
And there are, I think, a couple things in this episode that I didn't get the first time. And the second time I was like, oh, okay. Which, again, not the best look.
The episode starts in earnest after the opening with a strange circle wipe from the opening credits to backstage. So we don't have Kermit coming up in front of the curtain, as is typical. There is a wipe here, which leads me to believe that there couldn't have been an ad break between the opening and the first sketch.
I think they did that because, as we were just talking about, traditionally it starts with Kermit's intro.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. So I think they did that to transition the audience to be like, well, normally we just do this, but we have to do something different. We're doing something different.
The in-camera trick helps prepare the viewing audience to understand that this is not the same as a normal episode.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not the same as a normal episode because the backstage is full of flowers and garlands, and Kermit is also wearing a tuxedo. And he comments on all this as he walks across the backstage that this is being done because Sam is getting the place looking nice for Rudolph Nureyev.
He wants to class the joint up.
He's talking to Scooter, and he also is saying that he and Robin don't wish that they had to wear these formal clothes.
Robin's hat is huge.
Well,
because Kermit doesn't even notice him at first.
That's the joke, is that there's a top hat on the table that is almost completely enveloping Robin.
Me and Robin are mad we have to wear these formal clothes.
You and Robin, where's Robin?
Oh, right here.
It's the only hat I could find.
I unfortunately didn't find this joke landed. It's a good joke, and the hat is hilarious. But Robin's flippers are too obvious, and he's too much in the foreground for, I think, the audience not to be ahead of this joke.
Yeah, I think it's a joke on Kermit, not a joke on the audience. It's not supposed to be a reveal. It's supposed to be like, oh, how did you not notice that, Kermit? But yeah, it's fine. It is cute.
It is definitely cute.
Because Robin's always cute. Sam then, as you did at the beginning of the episode, say that Rudolph Nureyev is his favorite opera singer.
After first inspecting the three gentlemen backstage, he pulls Kermit's flippers up off the floor to make sure that they're nice and clean. I'm shocked that you skipped over a Muppet feet moment, Pete.
I did it because the internet would go crazy for it.
It's true. We want to keep our hit rate low.
We then go to the traditional opening with Kermit introing the show. Sam crashes because he says Kermit's not doing a dignified enough introduction for their guest tonight.
Henson starts about 30% of his sentences in this episode with the word
Yeah.
In general, his dynamic with Sam is wonderful. This is a very heavy Jim and Frank episode. In fact, once again, I don't think Dave is properly in this episode, or at least he doesn't have a speaking part. There is a very brief Gonzo appearance, and Zoot is in the Electric Mayhem. But so far as I could tell, Dave has no speaking roles in this app.
Who is Nigel?
Nigel is the band leader.
Oh, okay.
And he's in part of the kick line that comes out in the final musical number.
Yep, then that's it. Because in the fandom page, Dave is credited as Gonzo, Zoot, and Nigel in this episode.
So Sam is berating Kermit to do this with more dignity. And Kermit says, as I say, sorry, Sam, the first of, well, maybe no, there's before that when Sam says, did you wash your flippers? He says, yes, sir. There's a lot of accidental deference to Sam in this. He's so nervous because Sam is coming on so strong, which I think is, what is it they say in improv? He's coming across as high status in all of his scenes.
Sam, yeah, but that's always Sam.
But I don't think Kermit usually accepts Sam's higher status. Obviously, Sam is big and bully, but he's not. I think Kermit generally finds his attempts at making the show classy kind of laughable, whereas here, Kermit's in on Sam's attempt to make this a successful vehicle for their international star. And so he is cowed by Sam's passion to a degree.
I think I've always been intimidated by Sam, so I've just put that onto Kermit, but I think you're right. He usually just does it to do it, but it's more dismissive, where this one, yeah, he's more intimidated by it.
And that reversal happens right in this sketch, in that after going through the very formal introduction, he then says, but first we're going to get things started with Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, and Sam flips out.
Here to get things started is Dr. Teeth and the Electric...
What, Dr. Teeth?
That is not culture.
Kermit tries to pacify him by saying they're doing a minuet and they've promised to be very classy, to which Sam mutters, can I have that in writing? But Kermit bodily pushes him off stage.
Yeah, they got a show to run. He's got time to hit.
No, because it was 15 seconds to curtain, and then they spent 2 minutes backstage with nothing happening on stage.
No, the curtain raise, they introduced the show. That was the curtain raising.
So Kermit was in the O while also at the same time backstage with Sam working on introducing and what they needed to do.
No, there was dead air then.
Yeah, that's my point. They didn't have to rush out. Because the Muppet audience is well used to nothing happening for long stretches.
I wonder who, if they have an audience warm-up person. It would logically be Fozzie, because it's usually the comedian's job to keep the audience warm. But it's definitely not Fozzie.
Because he's the featured comedian.
Yeah.
You don't have, let's use TCGS as an example.
Mm-hmm.
When Connor Ratliff warms up the audience before the show starts, Connor can then also be a featured comedian on that same episode. It wouldn't detract from his power to be in the show after he's done the warm-up.
True, but usually when Connor was in the show, he wouldn't be doing the comedian bit. It would be a different bit.
He'd be doing whatever he was working on as his routine for that.
Or
as opposed to just doing straight jokes.
Character bit.
Yeah.
The warm-up is more audience crowd work or things like that.
I just wonder if there's a thing about the warm-up comedian not being in the show proper. If that's,
I think generally that's true because that's their everyday job. They're not going to be on the show every day.
All right, so who are we casting as the warm-up comedian for the Muppet Show?
I think I know. I think I have the perfect answer.
So it's not George.
It is not George. Oh. No, George is the janitor. He doesn't have time to warm up the audience. He's got a whole theater to clean. Even though I don't believe he's been introduced on the show yet, it's obviously Lou Zealand.
Who, after 2 seasons of successful warm-up, gets to become a regular on-screen, on-stage talent.
Yeah.
And somebody else would be the warm-up comedian.
It's
later.
The perfect answer. It's the only the answer.
I'm very impressed by that. As headcanon, I'm well in favor of that.
Uh-huh.
The minuet that Kermit has mentioned is by Luigi Boccherini and is one of the most famous pieces of classical music in the history of modern-day culture. It's, in fact, generally considered to be the piece that you play in the background of television and or movies if you're trying to connote, by the way, this is high culture. That is this string quintet that you play. And so it's the one you're thinking of right now.
Hey, what's this bummer called again?
Minuet G major.
They ought to send it back to the miners.
I tried to do a little tracing as to why this might have been in the public's mind eye as the theme song for classiness. There is a very famous example of this being used in the 1955 film The Lady Killers that Alec Guinness and his gang of thugs, which includes Peter Sellers and Herbert Lom, pretend to play this in the upstairs room of the woman's house where they're planning to rob a bank. But I couldn't find any examples from the 70s. According to the Naxos database of licensing classical music, it appears in This Is Spinal Tap in a performance very similar to the one we're about to hear, where a guy does a rock electric guitar interpretation of the song, and that was in 1984. In 1986, it's used in the fancy restaurant that Ferris Bueller goes to, Chez Louis. It's in Some Kind of Wonderful, also by John Hughes, the next year. So in the 80s, there was a swathe of it. And I think the influence of John Hughes can't be underestimated in terms of, but in terms of the 70s, I'm not sure it had been established yet.
Yeah.
Or at least my research at this point is inconclusive.
It may have just have been a piece of music that enough people were familiar with that they were like, oh, I recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
Ben? Boring.
The purpose of this sketch is that they play a Moog and synth-inflected adaptation of this for less than a minute while making jokes on top of it before Animal has a freak out and they all join in to a rock and roll version of it for about 12 measures. And then it's over. How long is this in total?
58 seconds.
It's 58 seconds, two-thirds of which are being done with jokes on top of it, and it's still boring?
Hated it.
You're absurd. I even dabbled with the idea that some of these jokes might be in my moments. They're that bad good.
To quote my notes, I like them trash-talking about the song while playing it, but not enough to think it's good.
Well, I'll say I love this sketch. This sketch is one of the ones that, after recording it in college, I turned into audio excerpts and listened to over and over again. But rewatching it for the podcast, I realized how badly visually directed this was. It's absolutely emblematic of what you talk about in terms of the cutting timing is all wrong. Mm-hmm. They keep on going to the instrumentalists after they're established as playing it. So you hear it first, and then it goes to them a couple of bars later.
Thank you for recognizing that I'm correct.
I maintain my earlier point, which is I think this is deliberate, in that once you hear it, you're then going to the person playing it, as opposed to going when they start playing. So I think it is a thing that the director thinks makes sense in his head.
It absolutely doesn't make sense.
It didn't work for me in this sketch.
I hate it.
I also found the choreography, the miming of the musicality, to be about as far off as the Electric Mayhem has ever been.
Ben, you're just adding evidence to my case that this is not good. Okay, I shouldn't say not good. It's boring.
See, I don't even care about watching it, though. I'm in for the jokes, I'm in for the audio, I'm in for the voice performance, I'm in for the timing of the jokes. I'm in for the instrumentation of the piece. In fact, Derek Scott's instrumentation throughout this episode, we'll get to Swine Lake later, is really good. He's doing some very smart things to turn classical music into an entertaining bastardized form that they can perform with the Muppet Orchestra.
Didn't notice that. You know why? Boring. I did write down a bunch of those quotes because they are very funny.
Yeah, good jokes.
Yeah, but music, boring.
Not very classy, Pete. Not very classy.
Never claimed to be. After that very boring piece of music, Statler and Waldorf has some things to say. Statler says, you know, the older I get, the more I appreciate good music.
Waldorf says, well, what's that got to do with what we just heard?
Nothing. Just thought I'd mention it. Exactly.
I mean, fantastic burn. I feel like the structure of this joke has been an insult that I have wheeled out about a half million times in my life since watching this episode in college.
Yeah, I've been a target of this exact joke countless times.
Every single Statler and Waldorf interaction in this episode has Statler start.
Yes.
And this is the only one that ends with Waldorf not getting the punchline at Statler's
expense.
Yes. And I thought that that was weird. Usually the show is good at balancing their dynamic so that they don't come out with one of the two of them sort of being the underdog of the pair. This episode weirdly failed at that, and I don't know why.
Huh. I didn't notice that part of it, but I absolutely noticed the Statler
starting each one.
Yeah.
So, as I just accused Pete, as the Electric Mayhem are coming off stage and complaining about what they just played, Kermit is saying, not very classy.
Not very cultural, guys. Not very
that
cultural.
That was degrading. That was awful.
And Mr. Nureyev must be shocked.
Kermit says he doubts it. Sam carries on listing a bunch of compliments that would support his theory. But Kermit tells Sam that Rudolf Nureyev is not here. He's running a little late.
At which point, when Sam says, okay, well, that means we have a little bit of a window so we can reestablish. We need to be dignified. We must be respectful. And there's an applause break as Nureyev walks up from the fire exit in the basement. And he is wearing a olive green jacket, a weird Canadian trucker flap hat.
The coolest jacket I've ever seen.
A red plaid flannel shirt. And he looks not like a ballet dancer, but more like someone who just got off a logging truck.
Yeah, or like a it being 78, like a countercultural hippie type of character.
See, that's what Sam says.
Get out of here, you freak! You hippie! You weirdo girl! Move! Move!
Whereas I don't see it. I really feel like he...
It's the hat and the jacket for me. I don't see logger. I see, like, hipster.
Yeah, I don't see hipster. I see a blue-collar working man. And so when Sam says, get out of here, you hippie, we're waiting for Mr. Nureyev, I needed jeans with patches. I needed torn clothing. I needed Woodstock for him to be a hippie. Now, maybe that's me being way too cliche.
Yeah, see, I'm thinking more disco style, which he's wearing that jacket. He's more stylish.
Oh, I get it. Sam, being Richard Nixon, is calling him a dirty hippie, but Sam can't tell the difference between current counterculture and former counterculture.
Yeah, any counterculture is hippies. Doesn't matter whether it's drug hippie or...
hipster hippie.
Yeah, cocaine Studio 54 hippie. They're all hippies.
Good argument.
But yes, he doesn't know it's Rudolf Nureyev. He throws him out immediately.
And comes back dusting his hands together and saying, who do these punk kids think they are? To which Kermit says, well, that one thought he was Rudolf Nureyev.
Yeah, Sam then screams, what?
And Kermit
essentially goes like, I don't know, but I have to go introduce the next bit.
Well, he has a great line. He says, I'm going to go introduce something cultural, which is a great way of getting out of this fiasco. He then says, in keeping with the tone of culture and criticism, I'm going to kill some time with this while we see if we still have a guest star. Which is just, I've been criticizing a bunch of things, but the wordplay in this and also how verbal and vocal this show is. Think about how long the backstage chat was between those four characters before they started. And then we have a good amount of back and forth between Sam and Kermit before Nureyev shows up, who shows up for a sentence and a half.
I'm here.
Not for long, you are not.
Before he shoot off stage, which could be about his command of English. It could be that they're creating business between the Muppets in order to make him not have to perform as much as possible. It helped reinforce the idea from the opening of him maybe not being there. Maybe what he's doing is he's performing on stage, but beyond that, maybe this is a stretch for him and they're trying to cover.
Well, this was recorded the year that the movie that Uncle Ken directed came out. That came out in 77. This was recorded in October 77. So it wouldn't have been his first time acting, but it wouldn't have been too much after he acted for the first time.
Kermit then says that they're going to be performing the love duet from the third act of Deflator Moose by Giuseppe Wagner, or Wagner, or whatever. What they're about to perform, they're about to do a piece of opera, and it's going to be performed between Link Hogthrob and Miss Piggy, who are going to be wearing and carrying weapons in conjunction with the sort of high operatic style that we associate with the Ring of the Nibelung and the Ring cycle and that Viking quality that is, you know, become the cliche of opera.
Yeah.
Pete?
Yes.
That's not Deflatormouse. Deflatormouse is not...
It's clearly German.
Giuseppe Verdi wrote Aida and Otello. Richard Wagner wrote Ring of the Nibelung. And the piece that they're performing is from Don Giovanni by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. So Kermit says nothing accurate. He's just squishing a whole bunch of stuff together. And I really think that the writers were like,
no one's going to know what we're doing anyway.
And so let's have a little bit of fun. But I think what they needed was the magnet gag. They came up with the idea of the magnet that Sam uses to get Link and Piggy off stage has to connect with the What's Opera Dark massive Valkyrie metal armor. So therefore they needed it to be Wagner-esque, but then they couldn't find a love duet from the Ring, so they just took whatever they could get away with and then made up the lines about getting the name wrong.
We proudly present the love duet from the third act of The Barber of Deflatormouse by Giuseppe Wagner or Giuseppe Wagner.
because they were like, oh, we can't have Don Giovanni with armor. That doesn't make any sense.
There were lines about it being the wrong opera?
Well, Kermit saying by Giuseppe Wagner or whatever, and him mispronouncing Deflatormouse. Him saying Deflator Moose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like the opera helmets had big moose antlers instead of horns.
True.
I think they're deliberately leaning into him squishing a bunch of concepts of opera together, but getting it inaccurate so that it doesn't matter. So that they can get away with the joke that they want without anybody recognizing or thinking they know the actual piece they're performing.
So here's the theory of this podcast. I didn't know any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that this wasn't from Deflatormouse. I didn't know that that wasn't Wagner. Didn't know anything you just said.
Well, I knew that Giuseppe wasn't Wagner's first name.
That's true. I suppose I did also know that. Because I didn't even bother to write Giuseppe down in my notes. I just wrote by Wagner.
And so that's what got me thinking, hang on, I know the name was wrong. And so I was like, okay, let's figure out what's going on here. If they're not doing it as a deliberate mashup in order to have the magnet gag, then I don't get what the concept of this sketch is.
I think it's a joke for five people.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a joke for opera fans, and they probably wrote it in there going, no one's going to get this. No one's going to know that this is a joke, but it's a joke.
Okay.
But I think your theory is otherwise correct. They came up with a magnet gag, and it probably went from there.
And then retroactively went back and wrote that line of dialogue because it would be a joke for five people.
Yeah. Wild speculation. Ben, you know what I appreciated about the opera sketch?
Okay, what did you appreciate about the opera sketch?
That Piggy and Hogthrob also were bored by the opera sketch.
Piggy was.
Both of them are. Whenever the other one is singing and it's not their turn, the other one is checked out.
Okay, I don't think Link is bored by the opera. I think Link is such an egotist that the only thing he cares about is being able to be on stage.
Okay.
And do his bit. And so he's just waiting for it to be his turn to be front and center again.
That's...
Piggy, and the comic tension of this is that Piggy also hates not being the person that is the main focus of the sketch and is therefore trying to upstage Link every time he's performing.
Okay, I agree with that. But still, neither of them wants to be in this sketch. Kind of.
Both of them want to be in this sketch as long as the other one isn't getting his flowers.
Because I found this boring. Not surprising. I am low culture.
I think, again, almost all of the classical music sketches in this episode are, they're trying to undercut the actual culture-ness of it. And so the joke here is that the lyrics don't matter. The song doesn't matter. What matters is the angry energy of the people performing it. Was that funny to you?
Yeah. Speaking of angry, there are two hits in the sketch.
Only two?
Only two. Because Hogthrob shoves Piggy off stage. She returns and hits him. And then the next time he gets control of lyrics again, he hits her in the face with a shield. But yeah, there's only technically two hits. Because it's after the second hit that the camera cuts to Sam in the wings and you see him pulling on something. Oh no, he's appalled.
Yes.
And then we go back to the screen and we see the magnet lower. And
Piggy shrieks when she's attracted and pulled onto the magnet. Yeah. And it cuts back to Sam pulling on the rope. And then it cuts back to them as full body Muppets with no people in them just dangling there.
Which I did love. And then it cuts back to Sam and he says, I hope Mr. Nureyev didn't see that. And then he releases the rope and they crash to the ground.
Sam's gone from thinking that Nureyev is a hippie who needs to be kicked out of the theater to being worried what he thinks real fast.
Well, yeah, because he just offended him.
It's true.
He needs to make up that he just threw the very high-cultured guest out of the theater.
Just stuck his foot firmly in his beak.
Yes.
What did Statler and Waldorf think of this sketch?
Well, Statler, as we established, had thoughts, and then Waldorf had comments on them. Statler says, you know, there's nothing like grand opera.
And Waldorf says, yep, and that was nothing like it.
He's not wrong. That was nothing like opera.
It was nothing like good opera.
Grand opera. After Statler and Waldorf, we go backstage again.
Mm-hmm. Sam is embarrassed and distressed.
Still looking for the forgiveness of the still absent Mr. Nureyev.
Kermit says, he forgives you, Sam. I just talked to him and he's not angry. He's just putting on his big costume for his ballet number. And Sam wants to know what ballet they're doing. And I have spoiled this joke, unfortunately, earlier in the episode. But it seems clear that this is the impetus for the whole episode.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the great pun machine that was the Muppet Writers' Room, somebody came up with the idea of Swine Lake instead of Swan Lake. And they were like, that's perfect. I wonder if we could get Rudolph Nureyev. That, to me, is my mind-reading assumption as to how this episode came about.
So I don't know about that. What I do know about is, they talked about this on the fandom, is when Rudolph agreed to be on the episode, they said, okay, who do you want to do stuff with? Like, which Muppets do you want to work with? And his first answer was Piggy.
Okay.
So they started trying to figure out Swine Lake, because he's been in Swan Lake hundreds of times, thousands of times, probably. That's probably when the Swine Lake pun came up. Mm. Or maybe you're right. They thought of it and were like, oh, it would be great if we could get Rudolph Nureyev. But yes, he requested work with Piggy. Obviously, you can't use Piggy in this full body dance thing. So they created this pig monstrosity costume as a workaround, and then gave him the later number with Piggy.
Okay. So this is sort of the center heart of the episode, the first performance by Nureyev. And he begins by doing a few bars of doing just pure opera. They're doing pure ballet. Gosh, sorry, Sam.
No, Sam's thrilled. He agrees with you. It was great opera.
Are you sure it's ballet, not opera?
Positive.
And just showing off his talents without any jokes built in. And it's in front of a huge backdrop of a castle and a forest, really emphasizing just how tall the Muppet Studio is.
Yep.
And
which then, also, going back to the last bit,
yeah,
Sam must have hauled that magnet from a very high height.
Or Sam realized that pulling them all the way up into the rafters was useless, which is why he dropped them so quickly. At which point, then, Kermit's done a plot synopsis of Swine Lake, where he's taken the essential plot of Swan Lake, of a witch that has turned a beautiful princess into a swan. That's basically what he sums up here, with a couple of excellent jokes thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
But so the first bit of him as the prince, straight ballet. Then the swine princess, the pig in a tutu, comes out, and the music goes from being a straight adaptation of the score to being that synthesizer, traditional Derek Scott orchestration of it, where they're doing the same music from the original ballet, but they're doing it with comedic fat noises built into it.
See, I didn't get any of this. You know why? It's dance. And it's maybe the only thing I like less than the Electric Mayhem.
And then as the sketch progresses, they stop doing the original, I believe, Tchaikovsky music and just sort of have their own comedic, almost circus music to end it up. But they're doing an exceptionally good job of adapting the original score, but with synthesizer choices in order to amp up the comedy.
Mm.
And is it a series of fat jokes? 100%. But it's very subconscious.
But it's not just a series of fat jokes. It is. But it's also just the same sketch as the Sandy Duncan sketch, where
I believe it's Sandy Duncan. I think it's Rita Moreno.
No, she wasn't the bar wasn't throwing she? The dummy around in the
I
bar.
I think she is. Rita Moreno in the French Cafe is what I have written down in the margins here, but I didn't double check. I just went from memory.
I'm inclined to believe you because I have no memory. Well, you're right, Ben.
What I don't know is that, and what the fandom page informed me, is that the pig ballerina is performed by a male dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is a dancer who has worked with the Muppets as a dancer multiple times. He's been a mutation. I wonder if he is the same dancer in the Rita Moreno sketch or not. And usually those dancers aren't listed or credited in that way. Mm. And the Wikia was on that dancer's page.
Mostly had credits for after this
correct.
Episode.
Did not list his various credits as a full-body Muppet dancer throughout the show. The dancer's name is Graham Fletcher, and in Jim Henson The Works and on his entry in the Muppet fandom page, there's a photograph of him getting into the pig costume as it's being built around him.
Yes.
With multiple layers of horizontal foam rubber creating the pig muscles underneath the then stretched over fabric that would go on top of it. And what's interesting to me is that famously in the Of Muppets and Men book, in the same chapter where they talk about Fleet Scribbler and how he was such an unsuccessful Muppet that they had to write out, there are two or three pages about a Muppet that was created for season 5 called Betsy Bird that was supposed to be a equivalent to Big Bird. And they hired a woman named Betsy who was a dancer, and they used that exact same technique to build out the costume. The comments from Jim in the interviews in that chapter are, he says, she was a fantastic dancer. She was very weird and had this amazingly bizarre physicality. And then the costume ruined it. Like, she wasn't as weird or funny because the costume obscured how much she was doing with her body. In this, the pig costume does an amazing job of obscuring the body so that you don't realize that what it is a short male dancer. In fact, he's so good as a ballerina that I never once doubted the femininity of the pig princess in this, because she's doing the sort of things that a ballerina would do in the arms of a male ballet dancer, where he holds her and she does the things of stretching. She goes on point. And watching it a second time with the knowledge that this was Graham Fletcher, I was doubly impressed that he had that much in his repertoire to be able to successfully mimic what a woman dancer would do in those roles. But I've always felt from watching ballet that this kind of things that men dancers do, you don't have the same huge variety of things that you need to do as a dancer.
Well, Graham Fletcher has Rudolf Nureyev to thank for that.
Okay.
So Rudolf Nureyev, one of the reasons why he's so famous, he's credited with Gene Kelly and, the other Hollywood dancer.
Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire, thank you. It's those three that are credited for making male dancing more popular and making it not such a female-centered role. Rudolf Nureyev in the ballet world, he was so popular and so good that shows were entirely created for male choreography because of him. So I'm sure Graham Fletcher got into ballet because Rudolf Nureyev paved that way, so that way he had roles to do, so he wasn't just lift, set, like, assist with the jump.
You're the crane for the ballerina.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that Nureyev is able to do some very good nonverbal acting, and this is the main place where that comic timing comes out, where he reacts to the appearance of the pig princess with dumbfounded looks, with wide eyes, and a very mime reaction. He throws the body about there as reference to the Rita Moreno-ness of it all. There are cuts between the empty pig costume and with Fletcher in the costume. He throws it up in the air. It then lands on him. He catches it. And then at the end, they both give a very professional, no jokes allowed bow to the audience of saying, I was making fun of you for being a pig princess before this, but now that it's over, I'm taking seriously that that was a good performance. Which is interesting is that it does undercut the jokes a little bit, because they get rid of the facade of their performances and are just professionals taking a bow to the audience.
Yeah, but even the jokes were choreographed, so it's still a well-choreographed performance.
I agree, but I think it is, when I watch it, I don't think, oh, the prince is disgusted by the pig princess. I think Nureyev is.
Gotcha. Because it's the Muppet Show, so they're, even though it's a performance, it's still the guest star.
And it still feels like they're being surprised as opposed to they prepped this.
Mm-hmm.
After the bows to camera and the virtual audience, we have a crossfade to Something Missing. Something's Missing is the third song by Paul Tracy, who we previously talked about as being the original songwriter for The Wishing Song from the Madeline Kahn episode and I'm Ugly as Sin from the Milton Berle episode. This is his first UK spot because the other two were both, well, I'm Ugly as Sin was an opening number and obviously you can't have a Madeline Kahn bit be cut for the episode. He has one more song that will appear in season 3 and it is also a UK spot. This is also the major departure from the theme of classiness. We have Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. We have opera. We have a minuet. We have things that are classical music, but this is just a humorous, well, it's not a pop song because no offense to Paul Tracy, but his stuff is not widely acknowledged as popular. Mm-hmm. But it is in the spirit, it's written in the spirit of that kind of popular music that would be in the show. And the essential concept is that a whatnot Muppet with one eye missing and half his hair missing and a beard on one side of his face and glasses on the other is talking about how something's missing from his life without the love of his life. And in the chorus, he says, something's missing, something's missing, something's, and then he disappears for the next two syllables and comes back for ing at the very end.
It's a fun wordplay song with fun vocal patterns, which, as we've established, are some of my favorite things.
And it fits right in with the Paul Tracy opus that we've established so far.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, you know, it doesn't really fit with the classy theme, except
okay,
there is a Mona Lisa in the background without a face.
That's good. That means we know it's not the real one, so we can destroy it in a fire.
Yes. Spoilers. So, yeah, there's classy stuff in there.
There's an elegant rose-painted tea set in the foreground.
There's a bust of someone without a head.
And then when, in the third verse, when his lady love appears, who gets a bit of a laugh because she looks like him.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a fake laugh, but somebody thought that they needed to underscore the weirdness that his missing half is kind of him.
Well, everyone's pet ends up looking like them.
The tea cakes and hors d'oeuvres from the tea set fill up and the flowers and the flowers appear on the stems in the vase. And
yeah, it's very cleverly designed.
Yeah. So it is a classy setting, if slightly undercut by the fact that this song isn't something that everybody would have heard of as part of high culture.
But the Americans didn't hear it at all.
As you mentioned, after that, we go to Vets Hospital, where the voiceover narrator informs us that this is a special episode of Veterinarians Hospital, where they'll be paying homage to William Shakespeare.
And instead of doing her typical business, Piggy is posing and, like, does the motion of, like, someone regally sweeping a cape in front of their body.
And as it pans off of her to everybody else, the pig underneath the operating blanket.
Animal watch. It's a pig.
And Rolf and Janice are also in various hyper-dramatic poses.
And they do a lot of Shakespeare-themed jokes. A lot of things related to Willie Shakes.
Including something I believe we've referred to on this podcast before, which is they lean into the idea that everybody in the audience would get the fact that Shakespeare's authorship of his own works is in dispute and Francis Bacon may have written it.
Yep.
A thing that still boggles my mind that they believed everybody would get that joke. Because they go straight from
this little piglet, sire.
Not piglet, Hamlet. Oh. Remember, we're doing Shakespeare here.
Well, sounds more like bacon.
And that's a laugh line.
Yeah, it's a good joke, if you get it. But it also, going back to what you said earlier about the writing on this episode, this Vet's Hospital might be the most jokes per minute of a Vet's Hospital that we've ever had.
But also successful jokes per minute.
Also true. They are not the dad joke groaners. These are clever jokes.
I think that this Vet's Hospital is actual laughs per second, as opposed to them just laughing at themselves.
Yes, agreed. It might be my favorite one. Although the business that they're doing outside of the jokes is minimal at best.
No, they're basically falling about laughing and then cutting very quickly back to the series of Shakespeare jokes.
Yeah, but like Piggy doesn't do any business when they...
It's actually more of a Janice and Bob sketch than not.
Yeah, when the voice comes up at the end, they do all look for it, but it, no one's doing business. They're just all looking in different directions, including the pig. So I'm disappointed in it in the other aspects of it. But verbally, yes, it is by far the best vet's hospital we've ever had.
Pete, do you know what zounds means?
It's a Shakespearean ejaculation.
Yes, but do you know what it means?
I think I just answered that by not answering your question then.
So the joke here is that everybody who's vaguely aware of Shakespeare or has needed to do Shakespeare-based improv has used the word zounds,
yeah,
because it's one of those Shakespeare words that you use in order to make Shakespeare Shakespeare. So in this case, Dr. Bob is listening to the chest of this little piglet sire and says,
I'm listening to this patient's heart. Zounds.
Zounds what?
Zounds terrible.
Well, zounds is an abbreviation where the part that's cut off in front of the z sound is God. It actually is God's wounds. So you would say God's teeth, God's breath, God's wounds, basically referring to the holes in the hands of Jesus Christ. So why isn't it zounds?
Because Bill Gates had to invent that in another 20 to 30 years.
In 2003, yeah, or whatever.
He had to do that as the...
I'm so disappointed that I got rid of my Stigmata-themed Microsoft Zunes. It had the best paint job. I know you had a camouflage one.
But... I had a Halo 3 one, thank you very much.
But it was still olive drab.
Yeah, it was kind of olive drab. But it wasn't camouflage pattern.
No, it wasn't. The sketch ends, as you say, with some good looking about in different directions, and then one last joke that is the worst of all of them.
Tune in next week when you'll hear Dr. Bob say,
Alas, poor pork, I knew thee well.
A sound-alike pun of Yorick from Hamlet, mm-hmm, sounding like pork if you really strain for it.
And yeah, that one could have been delivered better.
I actually think its delivery is about the only saving grace, is that they're aware of just how much they're stretching in order to make this an actual joke.
But they could have stretched it more to actually sound... They could have said porick instead of
pork.
Yeah, they could have done alas, poor... Porrick, and then really hammed it up to the camera.
Oh!
Because that would have been totally up their alley.
Statler and Waldorf follow that up with Statler saying that he's very offended by this because, after all, he was a student of Shakespeare.
And Waldorf says, what? You were a student with Shakespeare? That's not that much of an older joke. Like, if he's saying he was a student of him...
No, it meaning somebody who studied.
I know, but...
Not, like, who studied at his feet.
I understand that that's what Statler's saying, but it's just only like a 20-year difference between if he was a student of Shakespeare or a student with Shakespeare.
No.
I understand that that's not the joke.
Okay.
But it is the joke.
In the difference between the two uses of the word of.
Yes.
Piggy, because this is a Frank and Kermit episode, is now the one who's interacting with Kermit backstage and launches herself at him in order to discuss their duet. Kermit's confused, asks if there's something wrong with it. She says, no, it's wonderful. I'm so excited to be able to have a passionate duet between the two of us. And Kermit's like, well, actually, you're not doing it with me.
She's not that pleased to hear that. But then when he clarifies and says, no, you're doing it with Rudolf Nureyev, she becomes even more excited than she was. She picked him up at some point, but then drops him when she finds out and runs off stage to where she's going to be performing, accidentally stepping on Kermit. Doesn't count as a hit.
Robin then comes out in front of the curtain wearing his overwhelming top hat to say, my Uncle Kermit can't make the next introduction because he's trying to get the spiked heel marks off his throat. So, I mean, fine. But...
What are you talking about? This is great.
Piggy is in costume for this sketch that she's about to do, having come in from the left side of the screen after having just been on screen for Vet's Hospital. So she's coming from the dressing room, but there's no transition, where we often get a transition of people coming from the stage and walking backstage.
Okay, I see where you're going with this now.
And then, immediately after being trampled by Piggy's lustful exit to get ready to be with her pal Rudy, we then cut to Robin saying, Kermit can't make the next introduction as if it happened minutes ago as opposed to immediately thereafter. So we have two total lack of transitions on bookending this backstage segment.
I don't have a problem with the Robin part. I do now have a problem with the beginning of it part. If this and the UK spot switch spots, so if this faded to black, we came back, had the UK spot like we traditionally do, I would have no problems with Piggy coming in.
Yep, it would make perfect sense.
But, or even without the UK spot, if it faded to black and faded back up, implying there was the ad break. So if you did both of them before the ad break, still fine with it. But yeah, now that you mention it, I also don't like that. I don't have a problem because Robin's still probably under the hat on top of the table. So he's probably right there next to the stage anyway. And Kermit can easily go, can't do it, Robin, you do it. I do like the fact that it's a different hat.
Is it actually a different hat?
It is, because it sits on Robin's head. It as only covers to his head.
Completely going down to his legs.
Because I'm pretty sure, doesn't Sam come out?
Yeah.
During that, and
at the very end of that, after he finally then says, so here he is, the multi-talented Rudolf Nureyev, Sam wordlessly comes out and lifts the hat off of Robin's head, to which point he says, yeah, I know, the hat's still too big.
See, it's still too big, so it's a different hat.
Okay, I thought it
this meant, hat is still too big.
As opposed to, this is still the same hat, which is how I heard it.
Yeah.
No, you're right.
Ben, it's another example of, on multiple watches, the jokes are better, meaning they're not good the first time.
We then have a cut to a sauna where Piggy is in the sauna already, having gotten there to be ready for her Rudy. Nureyev comes in a robe and with a hood, takes it off, revealing some very nice pecs and a towel, which is in traditional 1970s modesty, covering his navel. And Piggy is stunned by this and says, holy maracas. Once again, doing the weirdness of Piggy's sometimes has Spanish heritage, but then claims Frenchness in order to try and be high status. And then proceeds to basically swan about, attempting to seduce.
Swine and, about.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
To seduce and or steal the towel from Rudolf Nureyev. There's a minute and 8 seconds of this before it's revealed to be a musical number. Now, we've already been told that this is a duet, but I still forgot that because it is a long intro. In fact, it makes it feel like a sketch that isn't going to be a musical number, but there's then a cut to a mid-shot that reveals the water of the sauna. Because the tight shots earlier didn't feel like preamble to a music number. And then the camera reminded me, oh yes it is, and the music started almost instantly thereafter.
Interesting.
This will happen again with the final musical number as well. There is a 40-second or 58-second intro, depending on whether or not you feel the intro is just Sam and Rudolph, or whether Kermit, Sam, and Rudolph all together. It would have been a normal backstage sketch. And at that point, it just is business to lead into the song.
Yeah.
Which gets back to my point about this being a very chatty, very written episode. That I was so invested in the business that I forgot this was supposed to be a song. Because the business was successful. It wasn't just, we need to have something in here in order to make this a song. It was just as good as a sketch.
Interesting, because the note I have is the dialogue between the two of them is kind of clunky.
The other thing I was thinking about, of course, is the male objectification.
See, I loved that. Because the song that they sing, we haven't mentioned it, in case you didn't watch the episode, listeners, is Baby It's Cold Outside. And so the reversal of the very popular comment of, oh, it's a rapey song, I liked it way more having her be assaulting him.
Whereas I was thinking about the strange double standard of you couldn't do this with a female guest. You're only allowed to have the sexualization of the guest when it's a hypersexual woman played by a man trying to get it off with the topless Rudy. But if this had been, for example, Florence Henderson, you couldn't have done this. You couldn't have made her an object of physical lust in this way.
Not in this way. I think if they were to do it with a female guest star, it would have been a more traditional version of Baby It's Cold Outside instead of this not Christmas themed, like a factual, it's cold outside, this sauna, you can't go out without dressing.
But it wouldn't have been, I'm trying to escape the amorous engagement of, to make somebody up, Gonzo.
I think it could have, but they wouldn't have been scantily clad. It would have just been the concept of, I'm attracted to you, I don't want you to leave, please stay.
But not homina, homina, homina.
Yeah, not you're in a bikini and I'm doing this. Yeah, no, that wouldn't have existed. But in this situation, loved every bit of it. Was totally on board with the objectification of this man.
Tangential note about the Muppets' relationship with this song. This is performed later in 2013 in the Muppet Holiday Spectacular, which appeared on ABC. That's not actually what it's called. It's actually called the Lady Gaga Muppet Holiday Spectacular, and featured as other guest stars RuPaul, Kristen Bell, and Lady Gaga's song partner in their version of this, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, interesting.
So Jogo Levs is right in the heart of his I'm doing old show tunes bit, but this is a year before Gaga's album with Tony Bennett comes out, which is called Cheek to Cheek in 2014. So this is literally immediately before she was really starting to be popularly known as somebody who was invested in, I mean, anybody who knows Lady Gaga's career.
She was more than a pop star.
Exactly. Knows that she is, you know, an artist interested in deconstructing, but also an incredibly well-trained classical musician. But there were plenty of people who just knew her as the person in the meat dress and that weirdo whose fans call themselves Little Monsters. She has a cameo in Muppets Most Wanted, and part of the purpose of this spectacular was to do a trailer for Muppets Most Wanted during the hour-long runtime. And so this was all a build-up for a lot of 2014 releases.
I'm looking up Jogo Levs.
My hit record co-star, Jogo Levs?
Yes, your co-star, Jogo Levs. Because he hosted SNL twice, and he famously recreated
Make 'Em Laugh
in one of them. And he hosted once in 2012, which would have been the year before that, and once in 2008 or 9. But I'm not seeing in the 2012.
No, I think it was the 2008 one was the Make 'Em Laugh.
Yeah. It would have been nicer if it was the 2012 one, because then he would have really been in his
in
his
the zone
classic bag.
The sketch ends with Piggy basically able to successfully wrest the towel away from Rudolf Nureyev, but he...
While kissing his torso 8 times. Counting those as human Muppet kisses. A Muppet was kissing a human.
Yep. He's able to then grab a blanket in order to cover himself up and then... Wily coyotes through the back wall in order to get away from her.
Letting all that warm air out and all that cold air in. Yeah, I really like this. The sound in the sketch is all over the place, too. Mm.
You think it's another example of a combination of backing track and live audio?
No, I think it's poor miking.
Okay.
Because Piggy sounds great throughout, because Frank is
mic'd got the headset down below, mic right there.
But Rudolph, in not having
a place to hide a mic.
Yeah. Is talking, and whoever was boom miking was not able to keep up with him.
I hold your hands, they're cold as ice.
Father,
how
worry.
Beautiful. What's your
My
hurt?
Father will be pacing that floor.
He's way quieter than she is, and there are moments where he turns and then becomes even less audible.
So you really think that this was live audio?
Yeah.
Interesting. Because I assumed that one of the reasons why I noticed the camera setup change was because they would have then needed to switch from live audio to recorded audio.
Yeah.
But that maybe, like the yodeling, they would have done some sort of a mix of live and studio because they needed parts of it to, for whatever reason, sync up.
Yeah, something. I don't know, but...
It's messy.
Yeah, it was wild to me to be like, how is he so quiet and she's so loud? And it's not a language barrier thing. It is truly volume-based. We cut back to Statler and Waldorf. Statler really enjoyed it. He's laughing, and he says, boy, he's really good, that Rudolf Nureyev. You know, I should really learn how to pronounce his name.
Waldorf says, I wouldn't bother. After all, he'll probably change it after having to be on this show.
Again, another example of my theory going out the window of them being complimentary to the guests. I mean, so Statler was
reinforcing the negative of the theory has now lasted longer than the theory itself.
Yep, exactly. Statler was complimentary towards him, but Waldorf was like, oh, he's not gonna.
No, I disagree. I think that's more about a slam of the show, that he's going to want to not be associated with this show afterwards.
Yeah,
Statler says he's great, and they both agree that he's great enough that he's going to want to not have this tarnish his reputation.
Yeah.
We have another aspect of classiness with Rolf performing Claude Debussy's Clair de Lune, and this seems like it's going to be a fairly straight performance on the piano, but then, as the camera pans around the piano, we see that Fozzie is hiding behind it, and he's saying, whispering in a very loud stage whisper, Rolf, you forgot your candelabra, I'll get it for you. And then the sketch becomes a back and forth of Fozzie failing to subtly get the candle. It's not a candelabra, that he needs to light it. He needs matches. The scraping of the matches is loud. So he goes back to get a lighter. And as he gets frustrated, he forgets more and more to be quiet and ends up just shouting.
Lighter! Lighter!
He eventually comes out with a propane torch, which he says, Rolf, this is going to be great. It's going to be a beautiful candle for you to play with. And then his butane torch burns through the candlestick, and Rolf just buries his head in his hands, weeping as Fozzie leaves, shouting for Gonzo.
It's a good bit.
So this wasn't boring.
No, because Fozzie's great. Fozzie's very funny. If it wasn't for that, oh yeah, I would have been bored to tears for 1.67 minutes.
So how is this different than the mayhem making jokes over the minuet?
Because it's entertaining to watch, because there's physical bits. Because otherwise, it's any other Electric Mayhem performance, which I already find boring.
Okay.
But there's physical comedy happening.
Solid answer.
Also, Ben?
Yeah?
You never saw that sketch before. Because unsurprisingly, Nickelodeon did not allow that to air.
Well, I may have not seen it on Nickelodeon, but I've seen that before. So either I watched this episode on these DVDs before, or it appeared in some other form someplace.
Could be. But yeah, unsurprisingly, like I said,
Nickelodeon was like,
playing with fire is not acceptable for children.
That sounds about right.
Especially in the post-Beavis and Butthead fire world.
We then go back to the guest star, where we have what feels like it's going to be a traditional short dressing room sketch, but then turns out to, as I mentioned, be a lengthy introduction to the final musical number. Kermit is saying, Rudolph, I wanted to tell you how delighted we've had you to be on the show tonight. And Rudolph is behind a changing folding screen. His head is sticking up above it, and it's been very clear the whole time that he's definitely wearing the collar to a black and white formal suit. So I was curious from the start as to what is going on, what is he changing into? I thought maybe it would be like Madeline Kahn putting on clown stuff, and so that when Sam is like, I'm sorry you had to debase yourself, but now for the third performance, you're finally going to do something classy, and he would come out in some ridiculous getup, but I could tell the whole time, he's wearing a nice suit, so how is Sam going to be mad at this?
Which Sam thinks he's going to do a classic ballet number, and a suit clearly isn't ballet. There's actually another Rudolf Nureyev story that in the Soviet Union, there was a performance before he defected where he delayed the performance for 40 minutes because he performed the first half in tights, but men at that time weren't allowed to wear tights because it was unbecoming. But he thought thematically or something that he should be performing this role in tights. And in the intermission, they would not continue the show until he changed. And he delayed it by 40 minutes because he said, no, that's, I need to be in tights for this, and eventually relented.
See, that I don't understand that anecdote, Pete, because I've been taught that, Pete, in Soviet Russia, the performance delays you.
Thanks, Yakov Smirnov.
Did I just spend that whole anecdote waiting to be able to bust that out? Yes, I did.
Hey, Ben, did you just that unusual me?
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
absolutely. You came up with a joke and went, I'm not listening to anything else because I just got to listen for my opening to say the dumb thing that I just thought of.
Yes.
Now I know what it's like to be on the receiving end of it. It's fine.
Anyway, Rudolph isn't doing a ballet. He is doing a tap routine. Speaking of Fred Astaire, this is a classic Rodgers and Astaire number from the 1935 film Top Hat, which Wikipedia informs me is the most well-respected of the 9 film collaborations between Astaire and Rodgers.
Interesting. I just punched this up. So in another segment of 45 years, people make anything better. Rudolph should have gotten the top hat off of Robin. Because he steps out from the thing, grabs a top hat, and puts it on as the music starts. Robin should have been in the dressing room underneath the top hat again, and he should have grabbed it, and it should have fit him perfectly.
Yeah, one more complaint about, I guess the hat's too big, and he could have been like, no, it's perfect.
Yep. Come on, Muppet Show.
Why can't you also travel through time and write your jokes according to our amateur status? This is, as you say, audio-wise, a bit clunky. And perhaps Rudolph Nureyev's weakest bit.
In terms of syncing, his dancing is phenomenal.
It's not as showy as some tap dance numbers I've been aware of. I'm thinking of the kind of choreography that we get in Anything Goes, where the movement is very much, you're really splashing your legs around in order to show how loud the tapping is and how much that you are making the sounds that everybody could hear, whereas he is being graceful and small in his foot movements. So he's not showing off, but his singing of the song is also not shown off.
Yeah. And as I said, the syncing, he's not even attempting most of it to try and make it seem like he's singing along.
They cut away to try and hide this, but there's enough where you can pretty much tell that he's just not on track.
When it cuts to him entering the stage, the whole first line, he's not even singing.
the vocals are there, but his mouth isn't doing anything at all.
And then he does a spin, and then he starts singing. He's definitely a dancer, and he's not a singer and a dancer, because he clearly can't do both at the same time. So good on him for attempting. So I cannot fault him
for stepping outside his comfort zone.
As I faulted other people for, you just did the thing that you're good at. He did more than that. He went outside his comfort zone, for sure.
And then the musical number ends in a strange way. Because he sings the first verse to Sam in the dressing room. And then he swans on stage to a to a huge big set. And I spent the second verse of this song wondering how the Muppets were going to be able to be on a stage where they're showing off his feet. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is they then cut for the third verse to a kick line of Muppets that comes onto stage from the side, close enough to the camera that we can't see their legs, and they're obscuring his feet. Now that we've established his dancing bona fides, in the second verse, we can block him a little bit with this. Mm-hmm. He then mimes using his cane like a machine gun and shoots the people on the end of the kick line, which starts with Nigel and then cuts to Mana.
Oh, okay.
Who's wearing a tux along with everybody else and singing along with everybody else. Not just doing scatting, but apparently able to sing the lyrics by Irving Berlin.
Yeah, and then ends with him mowing down the rest of the Muppets who are on stage.
Dancing in my tails, dancing in my tails.
I bet that in 76 this was creative and fun and in
the... Or a reference to something.
I don't know. I think it was just like, this is...
Goofy.
Yeah, this is goofy. Oh, Kane's a gun.
The traditional catchphrase of one of Disney's most famous characters.
Yeah. My Kane's a gun. And in the current year of 2023... Oh boy, it is not cool.
It is odd. I didn't find it, no pun intended, triggering, but it did surprise me that somebody thought it was a funny way to end the sketch. It is a strange variation on the Jim Henson concept of ending a sketch with an explosion to end with a hail of mimed gunfire. Mm-hmm. I don't know why one is worse than the other, but it is.
I mean, I do, which is explosions aren't nearly as common as gun violence.
Or personal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. I do think it's fun.
In a new use of that word previously undefined by Merriam-Webster.
Yeah. But it certainly doesn't age well. Mm-hmm. And again, the thesis of this podcast, the last 15 seconds of the sketch do not age well.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the performance itself was probably always a little stilted. But compared to what he's able to accomplish in the rest of the show, it is a particularly halting series of aspects to end on.
Mm-hmm. I also, knowing more about him in the research, looking back on it now, so in 83, I believe, is when he took the job with the Paris Ballet.
Okay.
So he's in the tail end of his full-time dancing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't be surprised if, as you were saying, he's not being traditionally bombastic with his tap dancing. If he's doing the basics, because that might be all he can do at this point. Some more wild speculation on my part.
I'm sure we'd be able to come up with a pretty easy timeline of when he was only dancing part-time and when he stopped doing regular full-time performances. And
I definitely read things where people said that probably around this time that he started basically...
cutting back.
No, not being able to move.
Oh.
He would look like an 80-year-old man walking around because he was in constant pain. But then when he was on stage, he could push through it.
So he could perform, but that took everything out of it.
Pretty much, yeah.
We then have them in front of the Iron Curtain. Sorry, just the normal curtain. And Kermit comes out to say the incomparable Rudolf Nureyev. He comes out and joins him, says he's very glad because this has been a very different experience for him. Sam then comes out to once again try to apologize to Mr. Nureyev, but it turns out the twist is that what he's apologizing for is for...
Because Rudolph says, sorry you threw me out?
He says, no, I'm sorry I ever let you back in. And Rudolph says, oh, cool it, Baldy, takes his top hat, puts it on top of Sam's head, it falls off, and there's a moment of total silence before he then tries to put it back on again and everyone snaps back into character.
Yeah, Sam's hand even comes up to try and save it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it fell out of frame, oh boy.
Who knows how far it would fall
into
the gaps that the Muppet performers are emerging out of. And I love the fact that that's the take that they kept. Then, because everyone rushes on, they didn't call cut. They saved it, and then everybody kept going with the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably did two or three other takes. And then when they went back and looked at it, they were like, yep, let's keep the one with the error. It was more human. It was more something. It had an energy to it, and I really love it.
I find it offensive that Rudolph
uses Baldy as a
derogatory term. Yes, absolutely. I don't like it. He's no longer a friend of mine.
You're saying in today's standards, Rudolf Nureyev has been canceled?
By me, yes. I don't think he should be canceled culture-wide, but...
Bald Americans.
Unacceptable. So rude. After the credits, Statler has to say the last thing because Waldorf is sleeping. And he says, now wasn't that a cultural show?
And upon seeing that Waldorf is asleeping, Statler silently nods and then puts his head down on the lip of the box to join him.
And this is another thing that I didn't get the first time.
Hmm.
Because the way Statler puts his head down, the first watch, I thought he was trying to get closer to see what he was doing. And it was only on the second watch where the way he puts his hand down as well. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, no, he's going to sleep. But that first time, I was like, it was strange. So...
Well, Pete, you've talked about kisses, we've talked about when music has occurred, we've talked about hits, but let's sum up all of our totals so that those who are keeping a spreadsheet at home can follow along.
So, there were 2 hits, no explosions, 8 Muppet human kisses. Ben, you made a comment earlier in this episode that the music was very short.
Did I? Because I didn't intend to. I think a couple of songs were very short, but I actually went back and forth. I think there's a lot of music in this episode. It's just deceptive.
Mm.
His time on screen felt circumscribed at first, and then he, in the second half of the show, is in more and more. I think it's imbalanced as to how much it feels like he's going to be on the show.
But for example, the minuet in A major.
Yep.
Asked me specifically, how long was that?
Yeah.
You seem like, yeah, that makes sense because they're...
It to be about a minute.
Yeah. We're over the 50% mark in this episode.
You know what? I know that you were just saying the opposite, but I remain unsurprised.
Yeah.
What with the background music and how long Swine... I didn't time it, but I thought that Swine Lake felt long.
Swine Lake is nearly 3 minutes long.
And just how many pieces of the we're trying to show that we have high culture were music-based. Even though they were short, there were a lot of them.
Yeah. So that's the trap I was hoping you were going to fall into. Was like, oh yeah, there was a lot, but it was all short. So maybe it would be shorter. But no. It came in at 13 minutes and 48 seconds of music in a 26-minute, 28-second episode for 52.10%. 52.1%. There we go. That's a better way of saying that. Which is second highest percentage so far. And our third episode over the 50% mark. Bernadette Peters is still the leader in the clubhouse of 55.05%. As for rankings.
Yes. Now, this is what I was really laying the groundwork for over the course of this episode.
It was. You guessed that I was going to put this mid-tier.
Yeah.
I did some shuffling. A lot of things got moved around. I put this at 22.
Really? I mean, you know, you get to do this, but I'm surprised that his desire to step outside of the expectations of what people would think he would do and the broadness of his performance didn't overcome the fact that he was kind of a stilted, totally unnatural in the more so-called spontaneous backstage aspects of it.
And that is exactly why I put him at 22, is because I couldn't get over the fact at how stilted it all was. I think the only thing I legitimately enjoyed with no issues was Baby It's Cold Outside. Swine Lake was dancing, so I was bored.
That makes sense. See, I think Swine Lake is note perfect on every front. I think the parts where he does the straight ballet is good. I think the parts where he is mocking ballet or showing how ballet can be mock itself is good.
See, if I appreciated dance, I'm sure I would have gotten all those things. To me, I just went, this is the same game in the apparently Rita Moreno episode. And so I've seen this sketch before. It's just classier. And then Top Hat, White Tail, he's good in, but also the sound is weird and bad. Now, on the other hand, I tend to agree with you that this is otherwise a very well-written episode. But again, that's not what I'm measuring.
I'm measuring
star power. And so, yeah, I couldn't, with any good conscience, put this higher than other things.
So who was in 22 before?
Don Knotts.
So he went up or down?
Don is up to 21. Steve is up to 20. Edgar Bergen is up to 19. Teresa Brewer is still at 18. So there was a gap there. I just moved everyone up. Zero Mostel, still at 23. Still 24, still to go. There's still room, potentially.
Yeah, you could have bumped...
Zero down and put him at 23. But when I was thinking back on it, I was like, no, I'd rather watch the Don Knotts segments again over the Rudolph Nureyev sections. So, 22. I think that's what's left is our moments. So, well, Ben, why don't you tell me your first moment?
Appropriately, since you asked for my first moment, I'm going to say how much I loved Statler and Waldorf singing along to the theme song. I mean, there's not much to talk about because it's technically wordless, but...
It is onomatopoetic.
It is joyful in the way in which you said mocking. I didn't read it as mocking. I read it as fun. And upon my rewatch of this episode, I literally burst out laughing. I didn't remember that. For whatever reason, having watched this, having taped it, the parts with Sam saying, "What, Dr. Teeth?" Like, I knew that timing specific. It was so embedded in my memory. And yet, there were surprises in this episode, and that was one of them. And so, there was something about it that had eluded me when I saw this back in the 90s, and it was a fresh surprise to me now. And I was like, I gotta highlight just how weird and silly that is, even if I can't really say why, because what meat is there to talk about in that moment?
Yeah, but our moments don't need to have meat on them.
It's true.
That's the purpose of the moments. For my first moment, our second moment, I'm going to talk about a Sam and Kermit moment.
Mm.
In the second backstage section, when Sam kicks out Rudolph Nureyev, right after Kermit tells him that that was Rudolph Nureyev, Sam picks Kermit up to meet him at eye level, and he says,
"What?"
Just the fact that he can't look down, he needs to be on the same level as him.
Picking up and dropping Kermit is what I have written in red ink in the margins as a potential moment.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's funny. To me, the drop is the funny part.
I like that, but it's the I need to make eye contact with you.
This is how serious this is.
What?
I need to look you directly in your little green face.
Yeah. So your moment could be dropping.
No, I think I think that's the payoff, and I can't really separate those out. But yeah, those were beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Jim Frank dynamic in this is wonderful, and I think it's funny that they basically mime that later by having Piggy pick up and drop Kermit.
You're not doing it with me.
What?
No, you're going to do it with Rudolph Nureyev.
That it was like, yeah, we're going to do every theme and variation on this. But this is really just those two men picking at each other. And I think the Sam and Kermit dynamic has real energy, more than traditional Kermit Fozzie energy. And I think it has to do with the fact that for whatever reason, Sam is hi-hatting Kermit in this episode. That to me is funnier than Fozzie not having status in their traditional interactions.
But I also think we don't get this makeup a lot.
Yep.
So it's also different.
And so it's fresh.
Yeah.
Well, with that in mind, I'm going to point out the writing of Sam's prose style.
Mm.
Obviously, in the part that you just said, he's literally just bellowing what, and it's funny. But I also like the delivery of, he's my favorite opera singer. The self-satisfied sureness of him being so wrong. The later bit where he says, six of one, half dozen of the other. Culture is culture. That is so smart in terms of a snob literally wouldn't care what is good. But I'm going to focus in on the way in which he goes over the top in the apology with the line, bless you, frog. Thank you for those glad tidings. Like, he's really shoveling and gilding the lily in that particular moment. He's like, there's a little bit of subconscious in there of Sam's character trying to spin up, oh, maybe you won't notice that I've been such a fool by using highfalutin language. But also, it's just he's a big dope, and he thinks that it's more impressive to say these flowery things instead of just getting it and saying, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's good writing, it's good character, and it's superb delivery.
I'm going to get off the Frank train for a second.
Fair enough.
For my final moment, our fourth moment, and I'm going to talk about Kermit. And I'm going to talk about Kermit's reaction to something Sam says.
So, getting off of the dynamic between Frank and Jim for a little bit, let's talk about something that Jim does to Frank.
Yeah. In the closing moments of the episode, when Sam says to Rudolph, no, I'm sorry I ever let you back in, Kermit gives a horrified look that Sam said this to the guest star. And I, as we've both talked about in this episode, I didn't notice it the first time.
Mm.
On the rewatch, I saw it and I laughed out loud. So I encourage everyone to go find this moment and watch Kermit. And I think this is probably why they kept that take, now that I think about it. Because it's such a good moment for Kermit. If you can
picture Kermit's head.
It's just a hand. But if you can picture, like, the life draining out of a face because your coworker just said something to your honored guest star, Kermit would have turned a different shade of green. He would have turned yellow because all the blue left his face or something. I don't know. It's so good.
Well, speaking of nonverbal moments, I'm going to do my fifth, our final, my final moment as another thing that I will have a very hard time clipping in order to say one of the things I also laughed hardest at in this episode was during the fabulous Vets Hospital series of puns. You talked about them all looking in different directions when the voice came on. Mm-hmm. But the one that got me was when the Piggy says,
"Methinks we should take our leave."
Why?
Look at the time.
And they all look for a clock in different directions. They're all craning their heads around to be like, where is the time? It leads to the best of all the jokes, I think, which is the timing of the shrew, if the shrew fits, are top line dumb puns. And that I've never heard. Like, I've heard the Piglet Hamlet joke. A lot of these are fairly standard Shakespeare puns, but those two I never heard before. And I give top props to the writers team for coming up with them. But to get there, they had to do a dumb throwaway moment of look at the time. That's the setup to get there. So they do the absence of anything that makes sense. They just have them all look in different directions. Again, this is a sketch I've listened to 100 times. And yet it's the visual that really cracks me up. And I remember that. I listened to this sketch and I remember them all craning their heads for a beat.
Hey, the timing of the shrew.
And it makes me laugh.
Yeah, it's great. I got no pithy comment for this one.
You don't always have pithy comments.
Yeah, I like to have one.
Well, I think we're good without any more material. That would just pith me off.
Ew. That would work as a closer, except you're going to cut all that out.
Yep.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Salmon Friends.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. There are things, dates, facts, names, Shakespeare conspiracy theories, or data of any kind you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Sounds!
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 5, guest starring Judy Collins. Yay!